The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A few years ago, the playwright Lynn Nottage, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize, began working on a play set in Reading, Pennsylvania. Reading is an old factory town where the manufacturing jobs have been drying up for years. And in their place, there's unemployment, poverty, and outlet malls. Nottage, who's Black, was interested in how racial tension is linked to economic hardship. And she tells that story through three working-class women, along with their sons, the owner of the bar they hang out in, and the busboy. The play is called Sweat, and it premiered in 2015. And over the last year, as the presidential campaign of Donald Trump gathered steam, pitting the frustration of the white working class against minorities and immigrants, Sweat began to look remarkably prescient. It's just opened on Broadway in a terrific production, and the morning after I saw it, I sat down with Lynn Nottage and the director, Kate Wariski. I began by asking them about the initial research on the play when they traveled together to Reading, Pennsylvania.
So what happens the first time you show up? You announce yourself, you just drive down there, and here I am, Lynn Nottage, and Kate Wariski, and here we are to take the pulse of Reading. Is it as weird an experience as it is for a journalist?
It is really weird, and it's probably much more familiar to you than it is for me, because those are not muscles that I have. And Kate and I, for Ruined, we had experienced sort of going into a place that was completely unfamiliar and sort of...
There you're writing about East Africa, you're writing about Congo, and you went to Uganda.
We went to Uganda, and we didn't know anyone in Uganda, and we thought we'd just have to be brave and begin to ask questions. And I think that our approach in Reading was really similar. We reached out to the mayor, who was very welcoming. We reached out to the Reading Film Office. We reached out to some of the places like United Way. And from there, we met people, and then it rippled out.
And you show up, and how do you conduct your research sessions? You just have conversations? Now, if I go there, I'm there with a notebook, and I get people's names spelled correctly and their ages, because that's the nature of journalism. For a play, you're doing something maybe a little bit different, no?
I mean, part of it is experiential. We had there is someone who we met who is a Vietnam veteran, and his work is to help other veterans who are homeless. And so he will go and give them food, cigarettes, whatever. And so on my first trip, actually, to Reading, Lynn invited me to go with him, and we just walked for a long time to find these men. And so the interesting thing is the experience, and what you say is that it is a very strange time when you're walking with a stranger and you're trying to get to know them and see what their daily life is like.
So paint a picture of Reading for people who live elsewhere who are listening. What does the place look like?
I was surprised because of the physical beauty, and you know, and it's a combination of sort of colonial homes and homes that were built in the early and mid 20th century. You know, the architecture is quite striking, and you don't immediately see the poverty on the surface. Mm. It's a beautiful city.
So how do characters begin to form? How do you begin to see a play out of the raw stuff of reality? You're starting to talk to people about their losing their jobs, and the conditions of their lives. How do you begin to transform that into an imaginative work as opposed to journalism?
Well, I think for me, it's the moment of transition came when I was sitting in the room with these steel workers, and they told me a story that literally broke my heart. And I thought, oh, I'm feeling something so profound and something different. I have to go inside and investigate this feeling. These were, by and large, middle-aged white men who had worked in the same factory for between 25 to 40 years, who had completely bought into the American dream, had a whole notion of how their lives were going to proceed, probably for the next 25 years. They arrive at their factory one day and all of the machines are gone and they're told basically they don't have jobs. And if they want jobs, they're going to have to make these serious concessions, which involves giving up perhaps, you know, 50%
of their pay. And these are guys making how much money?
These are guys who are probably making $35 to $40 an hour. These were people who were solidly middle class, you know, who had homes and mortgages and who were taking vacations 2 weeks every year.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then woke up the next day and they had nothing. For a while, I think there was a belief that they would be able to get back into their factories. They were locked out. So they refused to sort of meet the company's demands. And they weren't even given sort of the privilege of striking, which is really the new tactic that's being used today. The factory actually remained with a couple of the machines intact, but they brought in what I think a lot of the industry is doing today is they're bringing in temps, people who will work, you know, for significantly less, and they can employ those people for a couple of months and then push them out without giving benefits.
And what's interesting of the many things that are interesting about the play, Sweat, is that the dynamics and the friendships are, at least in many ways, so easy that it's only when two women who are competing for the same job, one African-American, one white, the African-American woman gets the job, does that relationship suddenly become uneasy and much worse.
Right.
That their friendship is incredibly long-standing, beautiful, and other friendships and other dynamics in the play, the same thing. Did you find that to be part and parcel of Reading or your own experience or what?
It's interesting. Because a lot of times when we're in conversation with people in Reading, just under the surface was this unspoken racism. And when pressed, you'd say, well, why isn't Reading working now? And they sort of pushed the microphone aside. Let me tell you the truth. It's not working because of them. And when you press, well, who is them? And them is always who they consider the interlopers, the outsiders, the people who came and sort of changed the status quo.
And the person who exemplifies this most is at the center of the drama eventually is
Oscar, the busboy,
who is eventually seen as the great focus of resentment because he's crossing a picket line.
Right.
And you saw that play itself out in Reading?
Yeah, it definitely plays itself out in Reading is that you have a new generation of immigrants.
Where are they from?
Who in Reading, it's predominantly Puerto Rican and Dominican mm-hmm. immigrants who are entering into town. Who are seeking opportunity the same way that the wave of German, Italian immigrants and African-American immigrants that came saw their fortunes. And in some instances, because you have companies that are pushing out some of the higher wage employees, you have some of the new immigrants that are willing to take those jobs. Yeah. And there's a lot of resentment.
So you come home, essentially, both of you, and you have stacks of material. You have films, you have tapes, you have transcripts of interviews and notes and so on. Then what? How does it go from being that empirical material, to the play that swept me away last night?
It's interesting because I think that this is where I take a different path from perhaps you are a journalist, is that I push aside all of the research and then I don't look at it again. I need room to sort of be free and to roam.
Now, as a playwright and as a director, what political plays, what political theater that you've seen as growing up or as you've come along impressed you and influences you in terms of what's really strong and effective and moving at the same time?
For me, Athel Fugard, even, you know, when I was a child, I remember thinking that his work was
South African playwright,
and what impressed me about his writing is it felt both personal and political. So it wasn't easily digestible.
Lynn?
Yeah, for me, I think of when I came of age in the playwright is with Angels in America.
Tony Kushner's play,
which I remember seeing it, and it spoke so in such an extraordinary way to sort of at least the internal struggle that I was having lived through an age in which a lot of my friends and a lot of people who I admired were dying and trying to just digest that fact when you're only in your early 20s. And then also, it's the work of Anna Deavere Smith, Fires in the Marrow. I remember seeing that and just being so struck by how she engaged with a subject matter at the right moment when we needed to be inside that conversation.
Yeah. Are there particular perils of political playwriting as opposed to other forms?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think one of the perils is that people will resist what has to be said, which is something that we've definitely encountered. I think I actually could go on and on about this. I think that there is a real resistance in our culture to engage with political topics in the theater. And when you do, you're sort of immediately accused of being didactic mm-hmm. or having an agenda. And I'm really one of these people who's not afraid to say, yeah, it's okay to be—
What's wrong with having an agenda,
with agenda.
By the way?
It's like a lot of the writers I admire had agendas, you know.
Aristophanes had an agenda.
Everyone. It's like if you don't have an agenda, then why bother?
Right. One of the most amazing things—one of the theater productions that I wish I had seen is that you took this play to Reading itself. When it had finished at the Public Theater some months ago, you went on a road trip, essentially took everybody to Reading. Tell me the story of that, how it played, how the audience reacted. Why was it different from being in, you know, a stage in New York or Oregon or wherever?
It was a wholly different audience. And what was really exciting is that when the actors came, of course, they were so scared to do it in front of the Reading audience. They were worried that they may not seem like people from Reading. And so they had so much concern. And through the course of the evening, they were embraced and celebrated in such a wonderful
way.
How
did you feel that?
They were very vocal, first off, but also we also had a talk back. But what was interesting to me is how much... the acting just slightly changed, and particularly the role of Tracy, because in New York...
The white factory worker who's one of the main characters.
She has to really do quite a balancing act to constantly be liked. So she'll do something that's not really something that people will like, and then she immediately tries to be charming. And it's a real balancing act that she holds. And in Reading, when... She said that she was angry at her friend for taking a management job. There was a kind of loyalty that audience gave her. And so she played the role wildly differently, though it was very close to the same narrative. And so what was interesting is that the journey with that audience was, this is the woman who is right. She is right in what she's doing. And then you watch her step by step. And then we go to... the scene, which I cannot talk about, but what's interesting is the audience was so devastated by the end to watch the progression of that thought.
So interesting, and then you had a talk back at the end of the play, a question and answer session between you guys
and the
cast as well. What were the questions like? What was the back and forth like?
Well, you know, the thing that was most interesting is that it began as a Q&A, but ultimately, it became a testimonial where people stood up almost like at a revival meeting and told their stories. Like one woman stood up and she said, basically, thank you. I have been in this situation in which I've actually felt ashamed that I'm not working because it's been what has defined me for so long.
One of the words that keeps coursing through the play, one of the notions that keeps coursing through the play is visibility and invisibility. No less than it is in Ralph Ellison. And so in a sense, these people are being seen.
Yes.
But there's also a woman who I thought articulated something beautiful. She said in the talk back, she said, everyone gives 8 to 10 hours a day of their life to something. And all of us have that privilege. But many of us are not seen in what we do for those 8 or 10 hours. So thank you for presenting the work that we do for 8 to 10 hours a day.
Now, when you were researching this play, Donald Trump was still a kind of jokey real estate guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
When you went back for the talk back and the performance in Reading, he had been elected president of the United States. How has this affected the way we're looking at the play, the way the audience in Reading or New York is looking at the play, and your own view of it?
What's interesting is the moment that Trump was elected, the play shifted in meaning. And the actors had done maybe a week or I guess it was 3 weeks of performance before he was elected. And once he was elected, it became the play that articulated the voice of, quote unquote, the other side.
The Trump voter.
Yeah. And so people.
And did that come out in the talkbacks when you went to Reading?
No.
Interestingly, no.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think people were really very focused on the content of the play and not so much on the politics, because for them it was not a political play. For them it was a play about their reality.
Nevertheless, you get the sense that the people whom you talk to in your research are Trump voters.
Some of them are.
It's 50-50,
I'd say,
right?
It's 50-50. And even among some of the steelworkers that we interviewed, some of them were like staunch Bernie supporters and would never pull the lever for Trump. And then there's some, like there's one guy in particular who is a staunch Trump voter, but only, you know, as he said, because he wants to keep his gun and he believes that he's going to bring back jobs, not that he philosophically is in alignment with much of what Trump stands for.
It seems to be almost unfair for the play to be called the play of the first play of the Trump era. It's been around for a while.
It has.
But do you sense, even in New York, that you're going to get a different reaction now that it's moved to Broadway because of Trump in the White House?
You know, I'll say that this Broadway audience has been kind of tremendous in that it surprisingly is more diverse than the audience was at the public theater.
Anywhere else.
And I also think that it's an audience that doesn't come in with a certain set of expectations. They sit down and they engage with the play in front of them rather than the play that they've read about. And a lot of those people are from out of town. A lot of the folks are from pockets in the country that are very similar to Reading, and so it resonates for them.
What is that feel like sitting there last night? Where are you? Are you together? Are you backstage? Are you in the audience? What are you doing? How are you feeling?
We were doing multiple things. I mean, we had like I started
big tumbler of scotch backstage. Nothing like that.
Well, yes,
a little bit. we actually had a little.
Your secret is out.
A little pink champagne.
There was pink champagne.
Not exactly Keith Richards. A little pink champagne. That's it.
That's what we're doing.
God, you guys live on the wild
we
side.
We live right on the edge.
No, but I began watching the show with my son, who is 8 years old. We saw the first two scenes, and then I went down to the green room, and I hung out with some of the designers, and then Lynn had watched the first act in the theater, and then we met.
We met, and we decided to watch the second act.
Half
in the
drunk,
green room. Sipping pink champagne.
Well, you deserve it. And do you have any idea now that it's well launched on Broadway? Do you know where you're going with the next thing?
The next play?
Yeah.
Well, I actually have a sequel called Floyd, which is set in Reading, and it's a comedy.
Well, there's a piece of news.
And it's, I think it's kind of, yeah, you know, I felt like we need to laugh a little bit now.
Thank you so much, Lynn and Kate. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You guys were great. Terrific.
Well, thank you.
Director Kate Wariski and playwright Lynn Nottage, whose play Sweat just opened on Broadway.